It was the 12th century Cistercian monk Bernard of Clairvaux who said, "You'll find something greater in woods than in books. Trees and stones will teach you that which you can never learn from masters." Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. Welcome to The Spirit of Things on RN, where you'll meet a young woman who decided to find out just how much she could learn about the meaning of life and about herself in the Australian bush.
In that moment, I am neither myself nor the bird, but both. I am the white-winged bird, the woman here now, and the one from 6 months ago. I am the rock I sit on, the valley below and the sky above. I am scorpion and crow and fire and moon. I am as timeless and eternal as the mountain range itself, the molten fires that push them upwards and the dreaming that created them.
For 10 years, Claire Dunn was a wilderness activist, saving the environment from exploitation, logging, and various forms of plant and animal extinction. Like others who've been on The Spirit of Things, working to save the natural world from degradation forms a big part of her values. In previous programs, we've heard from Buddhist Roshi Susan Murphy, and more recently from Catholic theologian Sister Elizabeth Johnson about their connection to the earth. This is how Claire Dunn describes hers.
We are expressions of a planet that is alive and responsive. A sentient universe dreaming itself into being moment by moment. Every movement both spontaneous and perfectly choreographed.
Poetic words, but they were hard-earned, as Claire Dunn set herself the task of living in the bush for a year with the barest essentials and no hot showers. She's written about her experience in a book, My Year Without Matches. Claire Dunn, or should I call you Wild Woman of the Earth? Welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thanks, Rachel.
Well, I think of you dusky with months of dirt forming a gray sheen on your skin, living in the bush, in the simplest shelter, and eating roadkill and snakes. And to me, you are a survivor. Do you feel that way?
I don't really feel like a survivor. I feel like it was I was so lucky to be able to have that experience. I've got such gratitude for having the time and the space and the opportunity and the support to immerse myself in the bush for a year. So, you know, there was hard elements to it, but overall it wasn't a hardship. It was just such a privilege.
Gosh, when you say it wasn't a hardship, I'm not so sure about that reading the detail, but it certainly is the fulfillment of a dream that many people have to actually absent themselves from the busy, the land of the busy, as you call it.
Yes, I do think it is an archetypal kind of desire that a lot of people have, not just to leave the land of the busy, but to immerse themselves in nature. The popularity of shows like Survivor and Man vs. Wild kind of speak of that fascination with that journey. And certainly for me, growing up, you know, reading books like Robin Davidson's Tracks and Adventures in the Forest and solo kind of self-discovery adventures always captured my imagination. And I was, just lucky enough to have the opportunity to do it myself.
Well, I confess that when I saw the title of your book, My Year Without Matches, I thought, okay, another person puts themselves to the test without the usual amenities and the cultural supports, and what could be novel about that? But then it occurred to me that it's precisely the fact that it is an age-old method of testing oneself and one's values that makes it more than just a novelty like all those programs you mentioned. But Claire, weren't you already living your values through your conservation work? Why wasn't that enough?
Well, it grew to be not enough. I'd been an environmental activist for the better part of a decade by the time I went bush, and it was a consuming passion for many years, and it was the way that I found myself as distinct from the world that I'd grown up in. And It was like my eyes had been uncovered to this world that was under threat from logging and so many things that I grew very passionate about. But after a while, and certainly when I was a paid campaigner, it became more of a job rather than a passion, because I was in the city, I was on a computer, I was snowed under with to-do lists and demands and election campaigning, and it started to feel like I was just a cardboard cutout in a drama playing out, that I was saying the right words but in a hollow voice, and I rarely got the opportunity to go bush, and sometimes I hadn't even visited the places that I was campaigning for towards the end. I also started to feel that the limitation to success of the campaigns I was working on was the fact that people like myself didn't have an intimacy with their natural world. So without that relationship, there was no way to feel what was going on. And statistics and facts and media grabs aren't enough to change people. We have to feel in our hearts what's going on and feel the desire to change. So it became obvious to me that without that relationship with the earth, that things weren't really going to change.
So you and your friend Chloe decided to sign up for a year in the bush, a year without matches. Where was it exactly?
It was on the north coast of New South Wales between Coffs Harbour and Grafton. So it wasn't way out in the middle of nowhere, but it was wild enough for what we needed.
And what was involved? What were the conditions of your life that year?
So the program, it was called an Independent Wilderness Studies program. It was quite a loosely facilitated course that basically set up an environment where we were stripped of most of modern comforts, but yet it wasn't going to be a man versus wild, testing ourselves against the limits kind of experience. It was more of a immersion in the natural world, using earth skills and wilderness survival skills as the mechanism to kind of have that experience. So we had to build our own shelters from just natural materials. I made a commitment to only light fires with sticks for the entire year. And we learned a whole range of other skills. Experts would come in the first few months of the year and teach us everything from fire making, hide tanning, hunting and gathering, primitive basketry and pottery and bird language and awareness. And after we'd learnt some of these skills, the last 6 months of the year was really a choose your own adventure without any structure whatsoever.
Hmm. So you had some food, you had some supplies. But
absolutely, yes. I wouldn't have lasted. I would have faded away within a week. The land couldn't have supported us for a start, and we didn't have the skills to do that, and it wasn't really the design of the program. So we bought in bulk dry food and had a very simple diet and went to town once a month and stocked up. So it wasn't a survivor, but we certainly were encouraged to put those skills to use as much as possible.
Well, probably the most challenging skill was building your shelter, and you had a very clear idea of what you wanted, a round one, sort of like a yurt.
Yes.
But pretty soon on, you called your parents and asked for help, and your father was more than ready to oblige with his saw and cutting down things. Wasn't that a bit of a cop-out? Weren't you cheating there?
It felt like a cop-out at the time, but I was quite desperate. We were given 2 months to build our shelters, and it took me 6 weeks off my own steam to put together a leaking lean-to, which I ended up turning into my kitchen, and it turned out to be fairly waterproof after 3 layers of paper bark. But I knew that my real shelter needed to be round, and I needed to thatch it with grass, which was a huge undertaking. And to actually put the frame up by myself was absolutely beyond me, I realised. So with great humility, I called my parents and asked them to come up for a few days to help me. And at first, we had a terrible time. I was quite resentful of the fact that even though I wanted to do it on my own, I had to call in my parents. But then I came to really see that what we were building together was almost like a cocoon that I was entering into to undergo some kind of transformation. And it was quite fitting that my parents were there to help me build the frame of that cocoon. It was quite poetic in a way. My dad and I kind of worked through some of our patterns through the building of that shelter, and I really was so grateful for their help, because I don't think I would have built that home otherwise, and it was such an incredible home to live in for that year.
Well, in writing about this, I get a sense there was a bit of competition amongst you all. I mean, probably looking at what the other was building, even though you each chose a fairly isolated spot. So I got the feeling after a while that this was a kind of Bush version of the TV home reno show, The Block, mixed with Survivor. Did it seem a bit like that to you?
Well, it was interesting, you know, there was all sorts of group dynamics going on, and a couple quickly formed, and then another kind of best friend couple formed, and they were helping each other out on their shelters. You know, without help, this was pretty difficult. And it was a little bit of also, you know, who's trying out what first. So someone tries out thatching, and then we wait to see if it works, and then if it works, then think, oh, okay, I'll do that then. It didn't feel competitive so much, but it certainly felt like you had to grab what you could get in terms of materials and help. And, you know, if someone found a good patch of grass to use for thatching, then you dived in there too. So there was certainly a sense of limited time and resources, and you had to choose your allies and make it happen.
Well, in that early stage of the year, I mean, in that first several weeks, what was your mental state like?
I'd left in such a kind of a rush that in one sense I couldn't wait to get there, and I assumed that once I got to the bush it would just be this unlimited time and space, and my mind would just slow down and I'd bliss out in this, you know, wonderful forest. But we arrived in summer, which on the North Coast is incredibly humid, and the insects were vicious. And, you know, we were thrown together in this hot pot of conflicting needs and desires and ideas of what the year was going to be like. So it was actually really quite stressful.
How many of you?
There were six of us, three men and three women.
Claire Dunn in the bush. She wants to be nature's apprentice, but the interpersonal dynamics between the six of them can get in the way. You're with the Spirit of Things on RN and Radio Australia, where we're discovering that being an environmentalist who decides to spend a year in the bush can mean some rude awakenings. Well, some of the things you had to do to make that shelter, making twine by stripping bark off saplings or making roof material by cutting the bark off trees, struck me, an urban dweller, as sort of damaging. How did the tree hugger in you feel about doing all this to these poor helpless trees and saplings just so that you could put together your temporary dream home?
Yes, it was a challenge at first, kind of going from tree hugger to tree lopper. I had to cut down a couple of small trees for my shelter and clear a site, and then start cutting saplings and bark and, you know, stripping paper bark for my roof and grass. It was a sense of taking from the land, and at first I was really confused about, you know, am I doing this in a sacred way? Am I just stripping the land? But after a while, what I came to see was taking from the land was actually giving me a much greater appreciation for my environment. So, for instance, I was making string from wattle and finding out that the different times of day that the wattle bark would easily strip off the tree, and then the times of day where it was dry and it didn't want to come off the tree, I started to understand the sap flows and how that relates to the times of the day and the water flows. It was like the key to unlocking a deeper relationship and appreciation and gratitude for those plants. And I also began really practicing asking the materials whether they wanted to become part of my shelter, and being quite open to whether there was a no in that.
How did you detect whether it was a yes or a no?
Well, I guess I just trusted that in the asking there was some type of ceremonial ritual going on, and that if I felt any discomfort, that I would leave the material be. So it became quite an important part of taking anything from the land, whether it would be food or for shelter, was just this routine of asking permission and asking the plant, would it like to be part of my shelter or my fire kit or whatever it may be?
Well, asking a plant is one thing, but asking a dying bird that you find on the beach, that's something else, looking into the eyes of a living being and taking life. Certainly life in the bush, or in fact survival, isn't a tranquil experience, is it? Did it help that you grew up in the country?
I think it did in one sense. I ran around on the riverbank and climbed trees growing up. I was lucky enough to grow up on a farm with my three older brothers and younger sister. So I've been watching my brothers catch fish and yabbies and witchetty grubs and what have you for years. So I had that sense of, you know, this is how life and death works. But I'd never killed an animal to feed myself before, and it was incredibly confronting. I don't think anything could have prepared me for it. But it was also one of the things that I knew I wanted out of that year, was that experience, because I eat meat and I'm uncomfortable with not having any kind of connection to the meat that I eat. And so the opportunity to actually engage in hunting and have that experience of the land directly providing nourishment for me and using every part of the animal to honour its life was such a significant event during that year. And there was a few times where that happened, and each time it was equally traumatic and exhilarating.
Did you ever get used to it? Doesn't sound like it.
No, I didn't get used to it. And the time where I trapped a wallaby, which was the time towards the end of the year where I really felt like it was time to take from the land I'd been living on, the process of actually asking permission to set this trap, and then the weeks of going to check the trap and really getting to know the movements of the wallaby and understanding their feeding patterns, it was like getting so intimate with this animal that was going to be my food. I ended up needing to set a very clear intention that I wanted to, you know, take a life. And when I found the wallaby dead, I was distraught, really. But carrying it back in my arms in the rain, those 3 kilometres, and thanking it over and over for its life, then going through the process of skinning it and gutting it and cooking it and tanning the hide, it was such an incredible process of coming to understand what it means to nourish oneself, and the understanding that the wallaby was in me, and where do I end and where does wallaby start, and that the life energy is constantly cycling through us. And it really expanded my sense of who I was. I didn't end at the skin so much anymore, but I was just part of this web of life. I was part of just another animal in the forest. And it was, it really just gave me that sense of that there is, you know, that the reason to live an honourable life is literally because we take in nourishment from other animals, and that's our duty, that's our way of repaying the gift that they've given us.
It certainly sounds like that was an experience, certainly far into the year, as you say, near to the end of the year, which kind of gives you the evidence or proves that you had finally achieved what you wanted to achieve. But it was difficult nonetheless getting there, being in the bush at night with nothing between you and the elements but twigs and bark and grass, bats, owls, and the odd snake. That would be challenging enough, but you had a fear of the dark. Why? Where did that come from? A country girl.
I think most people have a fear of the dark, and we just don't realize it until we find ourselves out in the forest alone, which few people do. I'd been trying to challenge my fear of the dark for a couple of years because it felt like such a limitation, and there was no rational reason to be scared at night. I went through all the things in my head. No, I'm not going to come under any, you know, wild dogs, or there was just nothing to be afraid of. But yet there was this incredible fear of the dark. And I feel like that comes from our conditioning of, you know, all the fairy tales and the stories we get told of you know, don't go out at night. And I was so scared that even to walk 10 meters away from another human at night into the dark was terrifying for me. And when I arrived in the bush, I thought I'd kind of got over that until the first night, and then I was a twig snap away from getting out of there. It took a while to become more comfortable, and it literally is a practice. The more time you spend, the fear, the less the fear was apparent. And then in winter, I spent a lot of time walking around at night, and I grew to absolutely love the nighttime, and different things would appear, and I'd feel the land in different ways. The night is so quiet, especially in winter, that my senses were able to just really soak in the landscape at night in a way that you don't during the day.
I wonder if you can read from your book a section that actually describes what you're hearing in the forest at night, in the bush at night.
As I fall into my swag, the sky is clearer than I ever remember seeing it. The stars bolt holes of pure light. Strange sounds punctuate the quiet, creating glorious mysteries. I want to unwrap them one by one, if only I could stay awake. I rub my eyes with oncoming sleep while the furry and feathered creatures of the dark blink theirs awake, meeting me at the dream junction. As the soft underbelly of night takes wing, I let my heart yield to the whispers, the secrets that crawl into my bed and curl up next to me, warm and beating next to my still body. Sleep transports me gently, as if I'm being carried by the current of a wide river, snaking its way further into the forest, drifting deeper into the darkening night. We use a soft whistle to locate each other at our rendezvous spot by the creek. The forest is skittish, with harried flaps of wings and scuttles in the brush, as if the day creatures are rushing to get home. With the moon fat and almost full, perhaps hungry owls are out early. Crickets and cicadas meet at the day's edge in overlapping waves of sound, a harsh staccato punctuating the smoother track of the evening. A night bird suddenly peals with a hooting cackle from somewhere above us. I startle, the hairs on my neck prickling. As I look up, a winged creature momentarily blots out the evening star. The throb in the background ratchets up a notch in pace and volume. Is it the doof or the sound of my heart beating in my chest?
That's from My Year Without Matches by Claire Dunn, my guest today on The Spirit of Things on RN and online. We're reaching into the dark night of the Australian bush and into the dark night of the soul. Combining both is Australian pianist and composer Luke Howard from last year's album Suncloud. Well, speaking of the dark, let's talk about the dark night of the soul. You were in a circle of friends when you admitted that as a young girl of about 4 or 5, you'd been sexually abused by a family friend. And that suddenly had an emotional impact on you, greater now than perhaps it had in a long time, maybe even since then. What do you think has been the effect of that experience on you?
Well, I've always had the memory, and I've never really had much emotional reaction to it. It wasn't particularly, you know, serious in some ways. But what was happening out there in the bush was my emotional world was loosening up more and more, and I was feeling more and more. And in winter, as I spent a lot of time alone, memories from the past were bubbling up and emotions that I never knew were there, kind of layers of grief and joy and anger and fear were arising without any particular trigger. And memories were surfacing and my dream world was extraordinarily rich.
Your dreams certainly were extraordinary.
Yes, it really was a sense of the kind of the night world and the dream world and the waking world merging, and this kind of underworld that I was occupying in winter just being filled with amazing dream images. And I started seeing the landscape more as a dream world in terms of symbol and sign. And so there was this whole kind of swirling of emotional material bubbling up. And one of the memories that kind of surfaced was this sexual abuse memory. And it really was the catalyst for a process that triggered a lot of anger, not just about that, really. That is more like the trigger for it. But it unleashed a kind of wave of emotion that was really in response to all the ways that I had been oppressed as a woman, as most women are in some way in our world, in our society, to have our wings clipped and told we shouldn't do this or we shouldn't do that, or even more so that, you know, we're trained to be human doings, to be striving and achieving, and that our identity is so caught up in what we do and how much we get done and productivity. So this memory got caught up with all the kind of unraveling of that conditioning that was going on for me in winter. And it culminated in quite a powerful physical response where I just danced and danced the emotion through me. And it felt like there was some kind of healing happening through physically moving this emotional material through my body and into the forest. It was like the forest was kind of soaking it up and I was unburdening myself of this emotional material.
Claire, but it does sound like it's what you do. You are a physical person, and in a sense you really needed to dance or throw yourself around or cry or scream out. But you also went to talk to your mentor on Skype, Malcolm. I'm not sure if mentor is quite the right word, but you would go to him for advice. And he refers to you healing. He said you need to heal. What was he referring to? Healing from what, do you think?
What he saw in me was someone who had taken themselves out to the forest and unwittingly set themselves up for transformative change. And that's really what I wanted. That's really what my intention was. But I really didn't know what that meant. And what he saw was a young woman who had been conditioned by her upbringing and her culture to base her identity around what I would do, what I could achieve at the end of my day. And my identity was so caught up in that conditioning of doing and achieving and busyness and striving and ambition. And so he was suggesting and encouraging me to actually rediscover the feminine, which is where I would be moved by my emotional world, by desire, by impulse, and trust my instinctive self. In basic terms, it was moving my operating system from the head to the heart.
Yes, there is a kind of relentless dialogue between the two sides of yourself, one always busy proving you can do all the tasks that you have set for yourself, while the other side is yearning just to follow your heart and be in the moment. Why do you think, though, that relaxing and taking it easy for its own sake has been so hard for you? I mean, you mentioned family conditioning. Is it in fact something you learned from your parents?
Well, I think my parents, they run a small business. They were always incredibly busy. I don't think my upbringing was particularly different to many other people. My parents were incredibly supportive of me and really encouraged me to be, the best that I could be in everything. And I took that as, be extraordinary in everything you did. And I don't think I was alone in that. And really, my upbringing was very similar to most of my friends, in which we were given every opportunity to follow whatever we wanted to do. But there was a pressure to really make something of our lives and to show what we could do with our talents and our gifts. And that can get very tangled up with an identity that's based around striving and ambition. And I found that I just found it incredibly difficult to follow that desire to rest. I was deeply exhausted. I'd come to the forest to heal. I wanted to stop. I didn't have anything that I had to do. And yet I found myself writing lists in my journal and, you know, setting myself tasks of learning these amazing skills and how good was I at fire and tracking and all these things that became kind of my key performance indicators. So I switched the furniture, but yet the same way of operating was, you know, still happening. And it was incredibly painful to see how rigid and controlling I was around what I thought I should do for my day. So it was a struggle for me between following the passion of the skills and yet needing to really stop. And I came to see that my task that year was not about becoming a skills guru or becoming a, you know, bush ninja, but actually it was to learn how to be and to undo that conditioning that says I'm only as good as what I show for my day, whether that's a primitive basket or a corporate job. My task was really to sit and watch and learn a receptivity and to let the forest and the world come to me rather than going out and striving to make something of myself in that environment. And the forest was an incredible teacher in that.
You call yourself a questing beast. I thought that was a very funny conjunction of terms. A questing beast. There's a muscularity, obviously, about that. So was that a reference to you being a quester after skills, and now you have decided that perhaps the quest should be more spiritual?
I think what I meant by questing beast was this deep desire in me for truth and for authenticity in my life and for finding and following my life's passion. I've always been someone who has a strong draw to the spiritual and to the mystical, and it was that drew me out to the forest. And I wanted just to pare everything down to its bare simplicity so that I would find what's underneath all the layers of the busyness. And I wanted something raw and gritty and real, and this was the way that I found to do that. But of course, a questing beast also has a sense of, that trying and the striving and the desire for truth that can't be found by looking and searching. It can only be found by letting it be. And that was a conundrum for me that year, was this deep desire to come into a sense of myself and an experience of my essential self without the layers of the city and without the layers of that identity I'd left. And yet I couldn't find that while I was trying to look for it.
Well, women have played an important role in your life. And indeed, one of the books you took with you was Women Who Run With the Wolves, speaking of beasts. You also had a painting of a woman with wild eyes that you hung in your hut. I think you've already alluded to the fact that you needed to find your feminine, but there seems to have been already quite a presence of women in your life, a lot of women friends, some of whom you write to.
Yes, and I think that I've been lucky enough to have wise women in my sphere who were pointing me in this direction before I went to the forest, and were really modelling a way of fluid connection with that feminine spirit that I found and wanted to embody so much. But I hadn't matured into it. When I entered into the forest, in hindsight, I really was a young woman who had was very much living the masculine kind of values of the external world. There was a lot of symbols that came to me during that year that really pointed towards finding that feminine. And a lot of my dreams were of cats and lions, and the native cat, the quoll, was a regular visitor in my dreams.
Yes, I think clawed at your ankles at some point.
Clawed at my ankles, and then I had lions cuddling up next to me. And I found this painting of this wild woman when I went to the Aboriginal Cultural Centre nearby when we were learning how to make eel and crab traps. And I wandered into the art gallery at lunchtime, and our eyes met, and I was drawn to her. She was on all fours, painted, and with these searing yellow eyes that were looking in mine, kind of challenging and pleading. And I read the title. It was Running with Wolves. And at the time, I was reading Women Who Run with the Wolves, which was incredibly powerful for me. It seemed to be absolutely mirroring my journey at the time. And I took this painting home. It was the first painting I'd ever bought. Put it in my first home, and that image was with me day and night in my shelter, and it really became a kind of a mascot or a kind of a guide in a way that I would check in with how am I going with this project of, you know, finding the wild woman. And the painting seemed to embody to me both the fierceness and the kind of power, but also this softness and flexibility that she mirrored in that painting of, you know, being within the grass and, you know, painted and this wild hair. It seemed to me to hold both those aspects of the feminine that I was looking for and wanting to embody.
Speaking of a guide, you also consulted tarot cards, which seemed to play a role in your life, and also your friends, I think, was it Chloe, who also consulted tarot cards?
Yes, there was a couple of times where we shuffled the pack, and both times, again, were very instrumental in guiding me to what I needed to do. The first time was an autumn equinox, and up until then it had been quite a communal life of building shelters and getting all our skills together, and I was craving time alone and really resentful of all this community tribal time we were having. And the three of us women went on an overnight mission to mark the autumn equinox, and we ended up finding this incredible cliff looking out to the west where we made a sacred fire all together with sticks and drew a card each, and the card I drew was the Hermit. And for me, looking at that picture of this woman in her cave by her fire, it was exactly what I was craving and needing. Quite soon after that, I took all the rest of my belongings that were in the communal area and lit my first fire in my shelter and really rolled down the thatched walls for hibernation. Very little grows on jagged rock. Be ground, be crumbled, so wildflowers will come up where you are. You have been stony for too many years. Try something different. Surrender. Rumi.
One of the great Sufi mystical poets, Jalaluddin Rumi, read there by Claire Dunn, who took his words to heart as she tested herself out in the Australian bush for a year. This is The Spirit of Things on RN Radio Australia and online. Download the program by going to our website, where you can find some pics of my guest and her very first, very own home, a thatched hut in the New South Wales bush. Now, don't try this on your own. Claire did have some supplies, access to a car and a hut nearby that had some internet connection. You wrote to six women friends around the world. This was at the latter end, the tail end of your year without matches. And they all gave you advice. Some of them affirmed the blessed act of valuing the moment, being in the moment. and also valuing yourself and turning every moment into a sacred act. Isn't that what religion does?
Mm. Absolutely. And I wondered whether my year might be better spent in a monastery or a, you know, nunnery or some such during the year to have more structure. But I wanted to have that experience of just being absolutely in touch with nature every day, and for the forest to be my teacher. I really felt like I was nature's apprentice, and that I what I needed to learn was going to be learnt in the wilds. And it was my church. The forest was right there at my doorstep. And I wrote to these wise women because I was really struggling with a question of when is it time to really kind of put yourself in hardship. And I was contemplating doing a vision quest, which is a traditional Native American ceremony of fasting and renunciation for a number of days in the forest. And part of me thought, well, this is what I want to do. You know, this is the path of the mystic. You need to go through these periods of renunciation and solitude. Another part of me didn't want that, you know, was really rebelling against that structure and wanted to just find my own way. And the wisdom that these women sent back to me was basically the message was follow your heart and follow that inner sense of rightness. And sometimes it is a time to do those rites of passage and those initiations. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes what you need is to get up, you know, put your jammies on and light a fire and drink miso soup and read a book. And the lessons that I needed to learn that year were about that softening and about that letting go. I'd done too much of the hard
spiritual or physical yakka.
That's right. I've done that. What I needed to do, the hardest thing for me was sitting in my hammock. It would have been easier for me in some ways to go and fast in the bush, because then I'd be doing something and I'd be achieving something. I could tick that off the list. It was much scarier for me to let those ideas go and to let myself hang out and to ask myself moment to moment, what do I feel like doing now? Not what I should do or what's on my list or what's the next kind of spiritual task to tick off or the next skill to achieve, but what do I feel like doing now? And that became the question that would direct my days, and that became the question that really took me to those places that I was able to embody that feminine way of being.
Do you have a spiritual practice, or are you in the process of kind of constructing one?
I have a spiritual practice in so much that I meditate every day. And during that year, my only structured practice was I'd do about a 20-minute meditation every day that was a listening meditation where I'd let all the sounds come to me rather than seeking them. And it was a way of sensitizing my body to my environment. And it really did work in that way. I found myself very highly attuned to the sounds of the birds and the feeling of the forest. So I try and still walk with awareness and look with a wide angle vision, which is some of these skills I learnt in the forest, of how to maintain that kind of base level instinctive awareness is a soft gaze and a soft walk. And I do meditate every day, or try to, and I sit retreats, meditation retreats when I can, but really, I feel like my practice is really still so connected to the wilds, and that's where I find most inspiration and solace and vision. It's where I become clear on what the next step is when I can go out alone to the wilds and spend that time.
But it is alone. You said going out alone. Mm. Is it a lonely path, an only path?
It can be, and that year that I spent, I was very intent on being alone. I was really a lone wolf and quite fierce in that, defending my boundaries. I love, absolutely love spending time in nature with people, and I think that this is the way that we need to go, is gathering together in wild places and experiencing the elements. But there is also a place for solitude, and there is something that happens when you're in nature alone that is unique. It's different to when I'm in a meditation retreat that's silent. It's when you're just alone in the more than human world, and there's nothing to hold up your human identity. There's nothing that mirrors back your humanness. What you're actually getting is a mirror of your instinctive, essential nature. Only solitude in nature can provide that. And I really feel that is a practice that is really needed in this world, to, in a way, rewild our inner landscape.
Rewild. It's a wonderful word. It's a wonderful verb. You realize at the end of the book that there's no way to go but where I am.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been a challenging place to remain for you?
Absolutely. It's been hard to find my place back in the real world. I have felt a sense of dislocation since leaving the bush, because I think I developed such a close connection that it really felt like uprooting from that relationship that I was in. There's been a lot of grief around leaving that, and I've tried living in the city and I've tried living out in the bush, and both of them have felt a sense of disconnection. So I feel like right now I'm finding a way to actually be in the present moment, and to have one foot in the wilds and one foot in the city, and have a lot more ease with that relationship now. There's periods that I go bush and there's periods that I'm in the city.
Well, you resolve to act as a bridge between the wilderness and urbanness. And I wonder whether the bridge is you. I mean, you're actually keeping yourself connected to the wild and to the city. How do you think you can bring the wilderness into our urban hearts?
I did feel like what I wanted to do was to bridge the worlds of the wild and the city when I left, and it started with words on a page, and that turned into a book over a number of years, and that's the way that I felt that I could do that most effectively, was to express the experience that I had that was so powerful for me. But actually, nothing can take away from the real experience of being out in the bush and sharing that with others, and I'd love to offer that experience and that opportunity to others. There is such a need for that rewilding of our soul, rewilding of the human spirit. Just as we're engaging in the rewilding of the physical landscape, our internal landscape is so domesticated and stripped of that instinctive awareness, that having those experiences and certainly learning wilderness skills is a doorway. It's a very powerful doorway into experiencing that kind of base level of instinct that we are, in essence. So I'm not sure how I'll be bridging the wilds and the city, but it's certainly my passion. And the most important thing is for me to maintain that sense of wildness, because what I've discovered is that wildness is not just a place, but it's a state of being, and it's a state of flow, because the forest is by nature in constant flow. And more I see the wildness in myself as a practice of maintaining that flow. And just like my wanders on the landscape, I would, you know, not set out with a plan of where I was going to end up. I find that living wildness is maintaining that sense of mystery, and not knowing where the path is going to take me next, and trusting that my feet are going to lead me in the right direction.
Gosh, that's a hard way to live, though, because most of us have to know exactly where we're going to be at a certain time of the day, because others depend on us, etc. So what you're describing there is very often suitable for singular life. It's harder to do when there's community that you're both obliged to and who expect things from you.
Yes.
Claire, there's a wonderful description of yourself that you write as a young woman poised at the edge of a fire on the edge of a vast escarpment, on the edge of time. And I was thinking, what's common to all of those? The edge. What kind of an edge is that? Is it a leading edge? Is it an edge you're hanging on to? Are you a leader, a time traveler? Is this a heroic image or is it a vulnerable image?
I think it's both a heroic image and a vulnerable image. And the classic hero's journey is about setting out on a quest of self-discovery and confronting challenges and bringing home the gifts for the tribe. And there's a great vulnerability in that. And I certainly don't feel like there was any kind of heroism in my journey, but there was certainly that quest for the truth and quest for freedom. And I feel like towards the end of that year, there was glimpses and real experiences of what it would be like to live in that state of flow that the forest modeled to me. And I think that edge is about living in that place of flow. And it is certainly hard in the world we live in. We live very controlled, structured lives in the city, but we can do it on the small scale. You know, we can take afternoons where we just go out to a wild place. It can be the park or the beaches. I mean, we're surrounded by national parks here. It doesn't need to be a year. It can be, I mean, an afternoon where you give yourself complete permission to walk where you feel like walking, to sit where you feel like sitting, to watch whatever captures your imagination. That is an incredibly powerful process, and that will change your experience of the world. And we can maintain that back in the city. It's that experience of not knowing what's around the corner and knowing that the world offers itself to our imagination and that it's a mystery. And just as amazing as all the wild creatures that I lived with are all the wild creatures that inhabit the city too. That's all of us.
All of us. Well, you talk about the hero going on a journey and bringing back gifts. And I think your book, A Year Without Matches, is a wonderful gift to all of us to learn to wild our hearts, to bring wildness into our hearts. Claire Dunn, thank you so much for being on The Spirit of Things. It's been a delight.
Thank you for having me, Rachel. Above me, the clouds are like hands dancing, reminding me that I never dance alone. That the earth is constantly extending an invitation, beckoning me to join it in conscious creation, the one happening right now in the millions of ways to move and be moved. It's my call whether I resist the dance or allow myself to flow with it, like wings over a valley.
Claire Dunn accepted the invitation to live in conscious creation with the earth. That's from her book, My Year Without Matches, an account of her time in the New South Wales bush, surviving with the bare minimum, but as I mentioned, not entirely alone and not without some basic food supplies. Would you do it? And if you did, what would be the one book you'd take with you? Send me a tweet at Spirit of Things. Next week, we begin a dip into the Spirit of Things archive with some of your favorite programs spanning the spiritual classics of the world, beginning with Tom Keneally reading the poetry of Jared Manley Hopkins, whose theology is surprisingly similar to the words of Claire Dunn we've heard today. So join me, Rachel Kahn, next week for a spiritual classic right here on RN.